Welcome back to Hill Country Institute Live, Exploring Christ and Culture. I'm Larry Linenschmidt, your host, and we're just absolutely delighted to have you with us today. We serve the body of Christ by encouraging and equipping followers of Jesus Christ to live fully and share His winsomeness, beauty, and reason. We invite you to visit our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, to listen to past programs, which are also available as podcasts on iTunes and Hill Country Institute Live. Audio and video from past conferences on faith and culture issues, such as faith and science, work and art, are available there as well, along with presentations on the works of C.S. Lewis and the Inklings. Some of our speakers include William Lane Craig, Alistair McGrath, Andy Crouch, Jonathan Dotson, and many others. We also ask you to consider a donation to support this program. You can donate through our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, or by calling 512-680-7993. If you'd like to sponsor this program, please contact us. The radio stations are our friends, but they like to be paid for their airtime, so help us keep them on the air, too. And now let's welcome again our special guest today, Steve Collier. Steve, we're just absolutely delighted to have you with us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
In our first segment, we kind of talked through your conversion to being a Christian, what was going on in your as a young man when you were 14 or so. We talked about your football ministry, and it ended with a pop. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, several pops.
Yes. So a hurt knee kept you from playing some of those last games or going further, whatever might have happened.
Right.
But you had a good closing with a longtime hero and being close to that time with the coach.
Do that with my Tom Landry was one of my heroes, and yes, it was very nice.
Yeah. Right. So God kind of wrapped that up, but then you stayed around. You finished your architecture degree, and you really weren't relying on the university at that point because they weren't going to continue to support you.
Well, something that was nice is architecture is a 5-year program, and I lettered in 4. So the university could have taken my scholarship away, but since many athletes redshirt, and so they get 5 years of scholarships, they paid for my last year. So it was very kind of them.
That really is.
So yeah. I stayed in the architecture program there, got married to my lovely wife, Barbie. And but because of the football timing, I crammed these 5 years into 6, so it took a little longer to get out.
Sure.
But there was really a transition from football is over now, you know, the next ministries are coming around, a family ministry. My wife and I were involved in a church startup, and a lot of interesting things happened there for the future. And
when you started in work, you were what I'm going to just call a conventional
architect. I was conventional architect, yes. Okay. You graduate with some good guys, and what's interesting about UT is it's a small program, and so we get some really good teaching, and so I graduated with some really good guys. I went to work for a professor, one of the professors there, Sinclair Black. It's a big honor to work for a professor. You do some wonderful work. They usually pick the cream of the crop, which is nice. They don't pay anything.
So almost like an internship, postdoctoral.
Yeah, it's even worse.
Yeah, okay.
Well, what's interesting is my wife and I, Barbie and I, had a great offer with a architectural firm in Dallas, Harwood K. Smith, HKS. They wanted me to come work up in Dallas, and that would have been great. I knew people in Dallas from that area. But we were part of this small church startup. And praying about what we wanted to do and the opportunities that are here in Austin, too, we felt like we needed to stay in Austin. Okay. So we took, you know, a big pay cut, mostly because we felt like God was going to teach us some very special things at this church that we were going to.
So you had a strong connection to the church?
Yes, yeah.
You had a strong connection to the pastor?
Exactly.
So, I mean, this I'm kind of leading. What
yes,
next
yes.
Kind of, yeah.
Well, Barbie and I were being mentored by the pastor and his wife. It was a small church, 200, 250. It may have gotten up to 400 or 500 at some point. But there was a small group, and we were you know, being mentored by them. And in a small church, you do, if you're in the leadership at all, you're doing everything. You're setting up the place, you're babysitting, you're, you know, do all the stuff. But one Sunday morning, some of the elders, these old elders, old wise elders who are probably 35 or 40.
The old guys.
Yeah, old guys. came, and I was babysitting, and they said, Steve, you need to be in the service today. And I had no idea why, but they insisted. And so they took my place, and I came into the service. And there was the pastor, one of them, a good friend, a mentor, was sitting there in the middle of the service. And the chairman of the elders gets up and starts reading Matthew 18 and just going through some of the lists of things that he had done and had started up again. And so it was a difficult time. A lot of people left the church at that time, and Westlake Bible started up around the same time. A lot of people who left helped start and did great things with Westlake Bible that's now Austin Ridge.
Yeah, yeah.
But Barbie and I felt like we needed to stay and stay there for a while. And looking back again, I could see God preparing us and me as a leader in the church, seeing that pastors are— my faith is not in the pastor. My faith is in Jesus Christ, and growing in Him. And so we stay. We felt like we needed to stay, and so we were in leaders there for many years. And,
I don't think there's any worse betrayal than someone in the faith who you've counted on doing these sorts of things, the sorts of things that bring up Matthew 18. So you had to overcome. What you must have had a natural desire to just bolt. I mean, that must have been the first thing that came to mind.
Well, actually, for some reason, it didn't. I think it probably did with others. But we were connected, not necessarily with that pastor.
With the whole fellowship.
With the whole fellowship. There are other good buddies there as well. Not all of them stayed because they— But our response was really more of one of we felt sorry for this guy. You know, he did betray us, but it didn't necessarily betray us to our face. It wasn't a, so we it was more we felt more compassion for that and felt like we needed to stay and help the church mend. And I don't want to say things against other people who may have left. They probably left for other good reasons or doing great things now. But we just felt like we needed to stay.
Well, I know Dan Davis. Taught us at Hope Chapel that when people left, you bless them. When a new church forms, you bless it. I mean, it's part of the body of Christ.
Exactly.
And so you want to have good bonds and good, caring, loving relationships.
Later on, as an elder of our church, I remember speaking to a lot of people who come and say they're thinking about leaving the church. And my advice to them is don't leave because you're leaving something. Leave because you're going to something. And be called somewhere. Don't leave because of you need to deal with something if there's something wrong in the church. But don't leave for that reason. Leave because you're called to another ministry. And I think I have a feeling that's what Dan Davis was talking about.
I think so. So you in that setting, you were you and Barbie had made a decision to stay in Austin, and. It seems, you know, just looking back, I don't know that you were called to be in that church at that time, and then you were maybe not desirous of this calling, but it was a prep for the future.
I could see we did all kinds of things in that church. We were I managed the monies. We were youth leaders. We did all kinds of things. I think God mainly prepared us by seeing. You know, people. People are different. I'll say that probably is a more kind way of looking at it. There's some wonderful people who just want to serve. There are other people who, a little more difficult. But
Well, the biblical reference that comes to mind is Moses. I mean, you know, he spent 40 years with sheep and then 40 years with people, and I think sometimes he might have wanted to go back to the sheep.
That's right.
So you, as a very young man, you were both building a career, a family. Your family started. You got married, and you were in this setting in the church. So that's really a three-pronged view of life that you've experienced and worked hard at each one.
Well, that was also that was the time. It takes 3 years after school. to become a registered architect. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And after that, I, following my father's footsteps in a way, I just went out on my own as an architect mm-hmm. and started designing homes and things like that. So I was just started the architectural practice, again, another ministry in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So
for someone with an artistic background and bent, I've always thought that architecture is a great place where you can put the concrete with the beauty. And does it seem that to you?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think that's probably why I went into architecture instead of art. My dad's a premier artist. I mean, he thinks art. He was incredible at it. But he married, like many, a very practical woman.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think I'm more like my mom in that I'm a little more practical. And so this architecture fits that. You're designing beautiful things, but they need to stand up so people don't die.
Sure.
So there's this interesting combination between art and physics and science and engineering that architecture works.
Yeah. So. And today, even in city planning, as we face massive growth and loss of green areas and all those things.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were going along as a sole practitioner, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a friend who had an inspection or, not sure inspection is a broad enough term, but I'm using that kind of came your way during some slow times.
Yes, there was a recession in 85.
Mm-hmm.
I had been out on my own since 83. I had two young daughters at the time, one and probably less than one. And let's see. The recession was similar to 2008, also the dot-com, just everything tanked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, I, being on my own, that's the only money I was making was through architecture.
Yeah.
I had a friend at our church, this church where I was talking about, who's doing what I'm doing now, this construction consulting work for lenders.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't keep it going, and so he had to move back to Seattle and just to try to make a living as well. I said, Steve, why don't you take this over, buy my company?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I bought his camera, and that was his company.
That was the company.
That was
the
company. And I already knew how to do what he did because it was related in many ways to architectural construction administration.
Mm-hmm.
But it was it had a different bent in that you're dealing with lenders instead of owners, and there's kind of a slightly different way of looking at it.
Sure.
But that helped a great deal. I don't think I made hardly any money the first 2 years in architecture or that. We were relying on savings. I think we sold a lot that we had considered building a home on,
mm-hmm.
and also wrote some software. I was just doing whatever I could to stay alive for 3 or 4 years.
I think that resonates with a lot of folks who've been in Austin in the good times and the bad times.
Yeah. But we were able to stay, which was wonderful, and it was also when we were going through a lot of things with that church,
mm-hmm.
and we eventually dropped the software as the economy started turning around, and so this consulting business started growing.
Mm-hmm.
You do decent work, and you do it honestly and well, and you serve your clients. Usually, that means they'll tell another client, and you get another client. So the consulting industry or the consulting world started moving forward, taking off, and I eventually brought on a partner there
mm-hmm.
in the 90s. And in the architectural world, a friend, a later friend, mm-hmm. moved in to Austin, and we started doing some work together at our church.
Okay.
And we met, started doing some work together. Eventually, we brought in one of his best friends who was working in Boston, who also played football at the University of Arkansas.
Oh,
I haven't really asked whether we may have been on the field at the same time. I'm not sure. I'd love to ask him about that.
Yeah.
But so these two businesses started doing well in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And when my girls, I have three daughters, and when my girls were getting teenagers, I felt like I needed to change. I needed to make a choice, and so I went on sabbatical and decided I needed to choose one. And so I kind of got out of the architectural world and stayed with the the consulting world.
One thing that's interesting about your exiting the architecture firm is how you managed it and your priority on your relationship with your partners. Mm-hmm. What could you tell the audience about that? Because I think that's when you change a situation,
yeah,
you want to stay close to people you are close to. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, we were all believers and, mm-hmm, and friends. And when I came back and said, I think I need to leave, I felt called to leave in ways. Mm-hmm. The next question is, well, what do you do? I mean, there's value in these companies. There are things related to money,
yeah,
and agreements and those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question comes up is how valuable I am. And and do they want to pay me to leave? And so those questions can get tricky among friends.
There's all kinds of problems that can surface there.
Yeah. So we decided, all three of us decided, that that we would go to a third party who would decide. And whatever this third party said, we would abide by and part as friends. And so we did that. And this guy was an accountant and said, well, this is the value. This is the value that Steve brings to the company. You really do owe him this piece. And so they did that. And we parted as friends. And I can't say it was rosy. I'm sure there are some tense is not the right word, but disappointments is probably a better term.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's questions of value.
Yeah.
And there's pride here and pride there. But afterwards, after it was over, we're still great friends. And my two partners are still doing great in architecture. They're doing wonderful work and all over the place.
So the idea of a third party, an independent valuation expert, if you will,
yeah,
stepping in, and everybody agreeing
that whatever he says is fine. Yeah. There's a humility to that I like,
mm-hmm,
that set the tone for the whole thing.
Yeah.
So
there's a sense of submission.
Yes.
That you're talking about at so many levels. You know, you submitted when you became a believer. You submitted in your,
yeah,
football ministry to what God led you to do. You know, there's an ongoing sense. Every one of us have to, every morning, and maybe several times during the day, just depending.
Right.
Be in submission again.
Yeah.
Because it's not a finished process.
Yeah. There's an obedience.
Yeah.
There's a situation back early in my architectural world. I don't know if you want me to talk about this as well, about obedience.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably in the early 90s. I had designed a home for a couple. It was a beautiful home in Pemberton Heights, a nice, beautiful area. And, you know, I hired an engineer and to do the structural area. And this is, we talked about rock. There was no rock under this place.
Uh-oh.
There was, you know, mud for 60 feet or so.
Mm-hmm.
So I build a home, but we design it. The contractor builds it. The engineer designs the foundation. It goes up and they're happy. They move in. And about 2 or 3 years later, one corner starts moving around and brick starts cracking and sheetrock starts moving. And so he goes to the and the warranty is up already. So he goes to the contractor and the engineer to say, well, what's wrong here? I need somebody to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds that he can't really get to the engineer directly because I'm the one who hired the engineer. So he had to bring me in. And so he, in essence, had to sue me,
mm-hmm,
and the contractor, sue me to get to the engineer. And I was still a young pup. I was still not making very much money, and this is a very expensive proposition that's going,
mm-hmm,
on.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, you know, why am I being drug into this? Because it's not my fault. I didn't design the foundation. The engineer did, and I didn't build the foundation. But I was being brought in, so I felt kind of bitter about the whole thing as it was moving on. And one evening, I was reading Matthew 5, and I came across the verse, if someone sues you for your coat, give them your cloak also. And I sat and thought and prayed about that and just decided, I'm going to do this. Whatever I come out of this thing, whatever comes out of this thing, whatever I'm liable for, I'm going to give an extra 10%. And what was amazing, I mean, it really was a wonderful time, because I came from bitterness. All of a sudden, it became a sense of anticipation. What is God going to do now?
Well, change of your heart.
Yeah, just change of heart. Mm-hmm. And that bitterness went away. And then as we were going through the mediation and those kind of things, it was interesting, because I didn't want to just necessarily – I wanted the truth.
Yeah.
So I defended myself, and I defended myself honestly. And had a real good lawyer and had a great man who was assisting me. But eventually, everybody has to pay something.
Mm-hmm.
And so my piece was part of it. It wasn't monstrous. It was thousands, but it wasn't, monstrous.
Yeah.
But it was wonderful to take to go see the guy who sued me and go up to his house have a check in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to tell him the story about, Matthew 5 and what happened. And here's the extra 10%.
Yeah.
And he was, flabbergasted.
Anybody would be.
Yeah. And it was wonderful. He said, I don't know what to do with this money. So he gave it to his favorite charity.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, my lawyer, who was one of the, best, known lawyers in town, I never got a bill from him. And I think after several months, I eventually called him and said, why haven't you sent me a bill? And he said, when you were telling me your story as we were in the middle of the mediation, I can't profit off something God was doing. And so I never had to pay his bill, so which offset a lot of things. But that was just that was a tone in the 80s when I was young, that if I actually do trust and obey, what God wants me to do, that he'll take care of me in some way.
That set a tone for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I agree.
There were a lot of early formation things that happened with you, and that's extraordinary. The setting that you're in now, we don't have a lot of time, but you're a trendsetter, you're a culture setter in your in your company for how people relate. And you've got a letter that you send to people, that when they start, if you don't mind, why don't we read that letter, and because it I think it helps to see what I hear from Steve, and what I take away personally is that when God starts a process with you, it's in many stages, it comes in many ways. The failure in the church taught you things that you wouldn't have learned any other way.
Exactly.
Sad way to learn, but it's a part of our lives as Christians. We pick up the pieces and let God show us the way out of that.
Yeah. Yes.
When he gives us a way to live in business and we do that, he honors that. And he then builds on what he's built on and changed in you.
Right.
And so this, I think, is part of why you have developed a company culture that's reflected in this. What is this?
Yeah. Well, being the founder in many ways and the CEO, you have the opportunity to hire people that are great people and influence them, mentor them as best you can.
Mm-hmm.
And several years ago, as we were creating our office manual, which has all kinds of restrictions and things like that, I wanted to open it. And these are open it with this letter. And this is the first thing that people that we hire read when we're hiring them. Mm-hmm. So I want to set the tone. And so if you don't mind, I'll try reading this. it's a letter from me personally. Welcome to CDCC. That's my company. We strive to make CDCC a very special place, not only because of the special people who work together every day and the unique relationship of trust we have with our clients, but because we have because what we do as a company has value beyond assessing risk and funding contractors. I see our work as a higher calling. I believe that what we do as a company has a broad effect for good, not only the good of the employees and clients, but for the people who produce the things purchased with the funds we approve. throughout our global industry. Our work of assessing and minimizing risks inherent in design and construction provides real estate lenders the assurances they need to make loans. And through those loans, lenders distribute money, the lubrication for the economic engine that distributes goods and services, provides work, and feeds families. I firmly believe that our work, the work we do every day, has value as we are part of God's work, His common grace of providing for the people and sustaining our world. We are part of something bigger and more important than ourselves. Steve Collier. So that's kind of the introduction to our office manual.
Yeah, Steve, I'm so excited to think about faith and culture issues in general, but to have somebody that's a practitioner, you know, living the faith, and that letter. I mean, I was just writing down all the things or some of the things that are there. You value people. It's real clear that when someone comes to work for you, they're valued. They're not just a number.
I hope they see that.
Yeah, and that's your intent.
That. Yeah.
You're working in a trust environment. You know, your clients trust you. The developers who you're counting on are trusting you to be fair in your assessment of what they built, the quality of it, and how much they've spent on it. So your clients are trusting you.
Yeah. If we lose trust in our service industry, we're gone.
Yeah. Everybody, you have competitors. You're not
yes.
the only one in the business.
Right.
You have what you call a higher calling. And that higher calling, as you are putting it, it encompasses not just making some money. You need, I mean, profit is essential. Profit's not a bad thing. Creating
right.
wealth's not
right.
a bad thing. You developed that idea well in your book. And by the way, I'll mention Steve's book again, Shrewd and Innocent, A Heart for Godliness and Ethics in Business. And I really, I think a lot of these ideas that we're touching on in Steve's story are developed in more detail there. But I love the way you're thinking of all of the stakeholders, the clients, the suppliers, and their families. And I think that the lessons in that opening statement and that introduction to the company go very far. So, Steve, we're going to have you back and talk more about the specifics of all these matters. So thank you. Thank you very much for being with us today. I hope we'll see you again soon. It's a great, great privilege and honor for me to get to interact with you. And I think our audience has a lot to take away from your experiences. So we're going to close out now this episode of Hill Country Institute Live, Exploring Christ and Culture. I'm Larry Linenschmidt, your host. I appreciate the time that we spent together. If you'd like to participate in supporting this program, contact us at 512-680-7993, 512-680-7993, or visit us at hillcountryinstitute.org. You can also hear this program on Hill Country Institute Live on iTunes and other podcasts. Thank you again for being with us. And remember to show the heart and mind of Christ.